This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good evening, folks. You're with Caroline and Ezra, and today is World Anti-Corruption Day, and we'll be speaking about that topic. Malaysia is no stranger to corruption. 2015 alone has seen a myriad of allegations of corruption amongst our government officials, and despite the existence of this thing called the Malaysian Anti-Corruption Commission, its true effectiveness has become less significant, while its independence from the government has been doubted.
Yeah, that's right. So we're going to look at parallels today. Hong Kong's Independent Commission Against Corruption, that's the ICAC, on the other hand, has successfully dealt with the corruption in general. So on the show this evening, we have with us Alex Tan from PwC Malaysia. Alex leads PwC's forensics team here, and he specializes in the prevention, detection, and response to financial crime, particularly fraud, corruption, conflicts of interest, and money laundering. That's a really big portfolio you got.
Yes, my mum couldn't have written it better, could they, Caroline?
We do our best.
And of course, just to wrap it up, Alex has over 25 years' experience, including 9 years as an inspectorate officer with the Royal Hong Kong Police Force and 8 years with the New Zealand Serious Fraud Office. We'll just stop right there. Alex, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
Good to have you back.
Thanks, Caroline. Thank you.
Let's kick things off about, I guess, in dealing with corruption. What was the sentiment like in both of your experiences in Hong Kong and New Zealand when it came to dealing with it?
Okay, well, if we look at Hong Kong first, luckily I grew up there and went to school there. So I moved to Hong Kong in 74 when corruption was rife. Went to school there and then went back and joined the police. And at that point, you know, corruption had almost been, it's never eradicated, but had been reduced significantly. Mm-hmm. And that took a whole generation. You know, it's not an overnight fix. So it took, 74 through to, the late 80s, early 90s. And there's still a bit pockets going on. As you know, ICAC have recently convicted the Kwok family and that. Mm. And then moving to New Zealand, which apparently has... was the cleanest country in the world, according to Transparency International.
Yeah.
But when I was at the Serious Fraud Office there, we prosecuted and convicted and jailed two sitting members of Parliament.
Right.
We launched a number of investigations. The Auditor General of New Zealand as well, we convicted him on fraud and corruption charges.
The Auditor General
of New
Zealand. The guy with the numbers.
Yeah. Yep, who was using taxpayers' money to fly to, when he was in Europe, fly helicopters for restaurant trips to Monaco and things like that.
Only Kim Kardashian does that.
Yeah. This guy.
Yeah, but he doesn't. I'm not sure if he has children with funny names.
No, that's right.
And so in doing so, I guess for whatever time frame that is required to, effectively deal with corruption, in both those experiences, were there initial hurdles that need to be dealt with?
Yeah, well, if you look at the Hong Kong example, ICAC set up about, 1974, 75, somewhere around there. And there was a big hurdle for them. It took a huge mind shift to bring in this independent organization.
We're talking about mind shift amongst
everybody, from the public sector through to the private sector. Who are these people coming in? And they brought in, and this is maybe a lesson to learn, they brought in a lot of overseas experts to staff the ICAC, a lot of UK police officers and that, mm-hmm. And then strong legislation, fairly onerous legislation, and that started having an impact. But just because they brought in foreign experts didn't mean it worked all the time. Some of these people from the UK police force were clearly out for a holiday in Hong Kong, a well-paid holiday. Other ones were very dedicated. But there was a lot of learnings to go through. And one of the things they had to do was they gave an amnesty to police, lower-level police officers involved in lower-level corruption. They basically drew a line. And that also worked. There was a whole load of different strategies that were employed to the point now where... police corruption in every country goes on. Okay, let's get that clear. But to the point now where public sector corruption in Hong Kong is generally lower than private sector corruption.
Right. Is it the same kind of base we're talking about? So, in comparison, we're looking at Hong Kong, we're looking at New Zealand and how they've had to go through their overhauls and the likes. And looking at Malaysia, taking it into context, is it the same baseline that we're coming from?
Yes and no. I mean, New Zealand's a different society from Asia. One of the issues in Asia, that does impact on corruption is that boss-subordinate relationship and father figure and elders and all that, that you respect them and senior figures in society.
The hierarchy.
Yeah, the hierarchy. Yeah. So, and that's manifested very recently in Toshiba. So Toshiba have got a big accounting scandal, and that was driven by the global CEO and the board. And nobody dared question it because it came from the top. And that was something that had to be overcome in Hong Kong and has to be overcome in Malaysia and Thailand and everywhere in Asia. In New Zealand, basically the bigger you are, the more they want to chop you off at the knees. Mm. You know, it's the tall poppy syndrome, so it's almost the opposite. So when there is sort of grand corruption or people in high positions seem to be doing well in that, there's more than enough people wanting to take you down. Mm. So it's almost the polar opposite.
I guess on that note itself, I mean, you mentioned how, I guess, New Zealand is a different society compared to Southeast Asia and Asia as a whole. Are there cultural factors that make it problematic to draw that line about low and medium and high level corruption?
Yeah, and one of the challenges also in Asia, which doesn't so much exist in Western side, and let's get this straight, corruption exists in every country, okay, at a different level. In the Asian countries, you have networking is very important. Relationships are very important. Entertainment's very important. So, in Western countries, like, you know, for example, New Zealand, you know, I'm happy to meet a client, an important client, over a $3 cup of coffee.
Yeah.
Whereas in Asian countries, that may involve a lavish dinner and so forth. So it's different.
Practically an insult to take them for a $3 cup of coffee.
If I take them for a tea tarik and roti canai, they may not be overly impressed.
No.
But in Asian countries, and that's one of the strengths of Asian country. You build strong networks, you build strong relationships. Gift giving is seems part. You know, you just have a look at Chinese New Year, Christmas, riot, all those there, hampers, etc. We've got that. Also, in some countries, particularly Hong Kong and China, it's a very cash society. People, you know, they want to carry around wads of cash to look important.
Right.
Wow. There are so many elements here. We're going to continue speaking to Alex Tan. He's the Director of Forensic Services, PwC Malaysia. It's World Anti-Corruption Day. And with some music first by the Rubens. Look good, feel good. BFM 89.9. Caroline and Ezra here on the Evening Edition. It's World Anti-Corruption Day. In the studio with us is Alex Tan, partner and forensics lead of PwC Malaysia. We were speaking earlier about the Hong Kong example. And Alex, the ICAC, I mean, a lot of, politicians in a lot of countries always look to the ICAC as an example. It was basically made independent of the rest of the civil service and the police to ensure it could carry out its duties without interference. You mentioned how it took a long time for their act to get together, but what were some of the factors that contributed to the ICAC's success?
Okay, one of the big factors, they had some onerous legislation, Section 10 of their act, which basically for civil servants made it an offence to have assets disproportionate to your income.
Right.
This was, you know, quite easy. You can just go to someone with, you know, you've got a Ferrari and a nice house and you only earn $10,000 a month. How do you get that? So unless you can explain that appropriately, it was a criminal offence. And that allowed them to get the foot in the door to do a lot of big investigations. Mm. That is rarely used anymore because under the Hong Kong Bill of Rights, there's a presumption of innocence, and this doesn't give you the presumption of innocence. They also managed to use this to help them nab a number of big fish. Peter Godber, a very senior police officer in Hong Kong, the capturing of him and the subsequent jailing of Peter Godber really helped turn the tide. They've also used, you know, they use a multi-pronged strategy, which includes, you know, prevention, detection, and also education. So, you know, I remember growing up, there were numerous posters and TV ads, etc., around corruption, but not just the grand corruption, about, you know, $50 to the police officer, that. So they were really nailing it at every level of corruption.
Mm, that's incredible. How important is it, though, for perceptions to get the big fish?
It is important because otherwise they just see, you know, people going after the little fish. But the problem is with the big fish in any society is they tend to be able to hide behind a lot of structures, legal structures. They have good advisors. So getting the evidence against a low level official who's taking 50, 100 ringgit is relatively easy. Mm. Getting evidence against somebody more senior that's hiding things through contracts, offshore accounts, etc., is a lot harder. So it's always harder to go after those big fish, which is why that Section 10 in the ICAC Act really helped.
Alex, I guess for somebody who has been in the game, whether it's the Royal Hong Kong Police Force or the New Zealand Serious Fraud Office, we have the organisation MACC, the Malaysian Anti-Corruption Commission. And when you see the news reports about its effectiveness or lack thereof, do you see what's working and what's not working, or are you sympathetic or do you empathize with some of the things that it is doing?
Well, I'll answer that in two ways. Firstly, we have a fair bit of dealings with the MACC for the investigations that we do, and the clients want to refer it to the MACC. So in those, I think we probably have, I don't know, three or four currently with the MACC at the moment. I can tell you hand on heart, all our dealings with them in relation to that have been first class. Mm. Absolutely professional, doing a very good job. You know, not cutting corners from what we can see. They don't give us fully informed, nor should they. You know, that it's sub judice, etc. So our dealings with them have been very good. And I'll give you an example of that. One of my clients is a multinational company, and they made a complaint, and the MACC needed the original records from this very well-known company, and we're going to go and serve a search warrant on them, which you do to get it legally, for the original records. And we talked to the MACC and said, look, well, rather than you marching in and searching, these records are all over the place, why don't you email us what you want? The client will get them all together, put them in a box for you. You come on over, hand over the warrant. They'll hand over the box, you know, in 2 weeks' time. They did that nice and nicely done. They got everything they needed, and the client's board overseas was very impressed with them.
Mm.
Yeah. Now, from the other side of things, the public perception about the MACC and some of the criticism it's been attracting, you know, there is a trust issue. There and the MACC, like any other law enforcement agency worldwide, has to get trust. But I know from working in these organizations in New Zealand and Hong Kong, you get a lot of mud thrown at you, and you can't have a right of reply. Unfortunately, the police forces of this world, the New Zealand Serious Fraud Office, the MACC, would dearly love to go out and say, actually, you're wrong here, here, and here, and here, but you can't. When I was in the Serious Fraud Office, we had books written about us. I had complaints written to the New Zealand Attorney General about me being in secret connivance with the CIA and just complete rubbish like that.
Wow.
And I have no right of reply. Mm. So maybe some of the criticism they've been given is warranted, but I can assure you probably there's a large amount that isn't. And if you could see behind the scenes, that may be so. And I'll give you another example of that. I know someone in one of their oversight operations review panel who has always been a critic of the MACC. And when he got, you know, went into that position, you know, he looked at some of the big fish cases and said, right, why didn't you go after this? When he looked at it, he said, they were correct. There was not sufficient evidence to the criminal standard of proof to prosecute. But you can't go out and display somebody's dirty laundry that you've been investigating in the public arena if there's not sufficient criminal evidence.
Well, is there anything that can, you know, that can be done to improve perceptions? Have you seen perceptions improve anywhere else?
Yeah, like I said, with Hong Kong, it took a whole generation. And from what I can see, with what the MACC, they're doing a very big outreach program at the moment. They are trying hard. They're doing things like, you know, in the last couple of years, they've set up 14 special courts just for corruption. Their conviction rate is almost on par with the ICAC. In actual fact, I think it's 1% higher than the ICAC in Hong Kong. So 5-6 years ago, the conviction rate was about, I can't remember, about 60% for the MACC. Now it's 78 or 80%. The ICAC is 77%. I think Singapore is 85%. So it's up, right up there, you know. And these are good news. I'm not defending everything the MACC does. And like I said, some of the criticism probably is warranted. But these are good news stories that have to get out there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they have a name and shame database, which is almost unique in the world. And I know the U.S. Embassy use that name and shame database when they're granting visas.
Mm.
And I guess, you know, what's really interesting is that we've had officers and officials from MACC come into our studios and we speak about some of these issues. And it almost seems that, you know, even when we take something as simple as whistleblowing, well, I would like to think it's simple, but even the processes in which whistleblowing takes place in the country, it's not those who have actually done the crime that are actually being investigated, but the whistleblower, him or herself. Are there ways in which we can make the environment a little bit more, I guess,
efficient or effective.
Effective in that regard.
So if we look at the whistleblowing legislation in Malaysia, it is a little bit ambiguous. So on the strict letter of the legislation, whether it gets enforced like that, it basically says if you want to blow the whistle, you must, in the first person you blow the whistle to must be a number of authorities, the police, the MACC, etc. That, on the strict reading of it, means that if I want to discuss it with my wife first, because I'm not sure, I've actually breached, you know. Now, whether you actually get prosecuted for that or not is another matter, but people want to talk to their lawyer, etc., first. But also, and this happens in a number of jurisdictions, if you commit a criminal offence, you can't get out of it by going and blowing the whistle on all your mates. It does happen in competition law, in cartel-type legislation, but not in criminal legislation and a lot of other criminal legislation. So they may need to have a look at that whistleblower thing to make it more user-friendly. I'm not sure if you want to go down the path of America where everyone blows the whistle because there's a financial reward at the end of the day. So
that is that effective?
It is.
It's a very cowboy kind of approach.
It is, and especially if you're the whistleblower who gets the benefit at the end of the day. There's GlaxoSmithKline, an internal auditor blew the whistle there, and her share of the fine was $90 million. So for her, it was very effective.
Talk about an incentive. All right.
We're going to continue our discussion with Alex Stein. It's World Anti-Corruption Day. He's the partner and forensics lead of PwC Malaysia. More after this. But first, Jet, La-Di-Da, BFM 89.9. Caroline and Ezra here of the evening edition. In the studio with us is Alex Stein, partner and forensics lead of PwC Malaysia. It's World Anti-Corruption Day. And with his experience in Hong Kong and New Zealand, we're trying to make sense of a lot of issues in relation to the topic of corruption. Alex, just give me an idea about how it works when you're tackling corruption, especially in very public and very big cases. And what I mean by that is that we have Malaysian persons and Malaysian properties being involved in other territories apart from Malaysia. We're thinking about New York, we're thinking about Melbourne, and these are very big and public cases. When they're happening in other jurisdictions and other territories, does an organization like MACC or any other organization, do they look at that and say, well, that's a window in which we perhaps can look in? Or is it a case of, well, we'll wait and see where the investigations pan out? What's the modus operandi?
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. So you do, when you look at these, you just see how you're going to get the evidence. Okay, so if it's in a jurisdiction that you have very little relationships with, it's going to be very difficult to get sufficient evidence. Unfortunately, a lot of people watch too much TV.
Yeah.
So you get this
but
evidence.
But it's true. Everything that happens
is
true.
It is. I mean, you know, you watch CSI, everything's done in 45 minutes.
Yeah, that's right.
Adverse.
What's going on?
That's right.
I know. I wish it was like that. But unfortunately, you ever watch too much TV. So let's just break that down. You want to get evidence in another jurisdiction, say New York, that's admissible in court in Malaysia. Hmm. Okay. You have to go through what's called a letter of request. It basically goes all the way through the Malaysian government for a formal request to go to the US government, the Department of Justice, and then it gets filtered all the way down and then determine whether it's sufficient, and then they issue a court order. That sounds, that's easy. That's a 6 to 12 month process.
Yeah.
Six to 12 months.
Yeah, because you
but
can imagine,
is that a common thing or is it a Malaysian thing?
No,
that's 6 to 12 months.
It's a common thing.
Right.
I can get information. You know, they can get information from an intelligence purpose. Can you tell us, does Alex have a bank account in New York, Australia, wherever? Okay. They can find out from there. But intelligence isn't useful. You can't use that in a court of law in most cases. You need to say, right, we've gone to the bank. This bank, here's the bank officer, he's provided this, it's stopped, it's stamped, it's done before a magistrate, et cetera, et cetera. It then goes in its form all the way through the diplomatic channels all the way back, you know? And that's what and then you look at it and say, oh, that's very good. But, oh, we see a big deposit going into that, withdrawal going into that other account. Can you please give us that? Okay, another letter of request goes all the way back through. And it just takes forever, which is why in any jurisdiction, you look at some of the trials in the UK for the SFO, it takes years and years and years. And people just move their money from one jurisdiction to the other, and you have to follow these through. And some jurisdictions are very easy. New Zealand was quite good because they have different sort of laws that facilitated that. Other jurisdictions can be very, very tight with their... I remember doing one from New Zealand to America, and I sent off the letter of request on the 9th of November, 2001. 2 days later, it was 9/11. To this day, there's still not been a response. from that.
So in that regard, I mean, you mentioned about how the processes, you know, they go through government institutions and all sorts of bureaucracy. Is it problematic then for some countries or for some areas where the institutions themselves are not completely transparent or fail to be accountable for these processes? So it's, where do you start?
Yeah, look. How you tackle that is a $64 million question. Every case stands and falls on its own legs. Yeah? We can't say, oh, well, because that institute is not transparent. I mean, I can tell you, for example, some people would think, well, this would be difficult. When I was in the police in Hong Kong, we had fantastic support from the Central Bank of Nigeria, for a lot of Nigerians. Everyone was saying, well, Nigeria, they're perceived to be very corrupt and more third world than anything else. They were absolutely fantastic. And other jurisdictions, more westernized jurisdictions, were nowhere near as helpful.
And as a result, is it the case then that there are just, in fact, only a few bad apples rather than the tarnish or the brush that it's been tainted upon that, you know, it's incompetent or these institutions are not really acting as they should be?
It's hard to give an exact figure on that. You know, if you're looking at incompetence, we can't unfortunately legislate against incompetence. Mm. You know? How nice if we could,
yes.
But we can't. So you know, incompetence is something we just can't factor in.
All right. So a question in from a listener actually is asking us to ask you about past AG reports where no improvements were reported. How does that help with perceptions, and what can be done to show accountability? What do you think?
Well, I mean, that has been an issue that's been brought up in Malaysia many times, and I know from other jurisdictions it's very hard for any government department to get up and say we made a mistake. You know, it is, because it is public funds. But that's the first step, and I've seen it in other jurisdictions where the government departments say, we have made a mistake and this is how we're accountable and we're going forward. But I think the fact is, at the moment, it gets tabled at every parliament session, doesn't it, the AG's report? It comes out three or four times a year. Whereas a couple of years ago, it didn't. So I think we're on the right track to doing it. But any public waste of money in any country is looked upon hardly, but I think toughly. But I think the fact that it's been tabled three times in Parliament now, it just got to keep at it and keep at it and keep at it, because public wastage is everybody, every taxpayer's money going into that.
Yeah, I think at least you know, for you and me, Caroline, when we went through that transition of Auditor General reports being once a year to every few years, there was a certain excitement from ourselves and from our listeners about this report being available every few months, but there is a certain
plateauing effect, I think, is what it is. Because yes, you're right, we were excited, and then when we began to see it with a lot of frequency and no improvements being reported in the media, not necessarily saying that no improvements were made, but no improvements reported in the media, then I suppose that excitement slowly died
down. And then it becomes par for the course where, well, you know, it's only a 5 million wastage. I mean, thank God it's 5 million.
Pretty much.
All right, we're going to continue with Alex Tan. We're speaking about corruption on World Anti-Corruption Day. He's the partner and forensics lead of PwC Malaysia. We'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors, BFM 89.9. It's World Anti-Corruption Day, and in the studio with us is Alex Tan. He's the partner and forensics lead of PwC Malaysia, and we're speaking to him about his experience in tackling corruption. Alex, the question I have for you is really targeted at what we can do in Malaysia moving forward. And I think one of the big issues and points of discussion right now is the issue of independence of these institutions. And in the examples that you've seen in New Zealand and in Hong Kong, how crucial is that so that respective bodies and authorities can actually carry out their investigations without interference?
Yeah, it is very important. But it's always difficult for politicians in any country to leave it completely independent. So even in New Zealand, there was, smatterings around the side of people trying to interfere at various stages. And luckily, the director of the Serious Fraud Office at various points said, "No, step away. You're impinging on our independence." But being independent is vitally important. But also, there has to be some form of oversight, because otherwise, you get a rogue agency just flying around doing what they want.
Right, so check and balance, I suppose. You know, from what you see of how Malaysia is doing it, what kind of work the MSCC is doing, I suppose the speed we're working at. So you said that Hong Kong took an entire generation to sort of clean things up. I'm just wondering whether there is a window, if you could predict how long it'll take us to clean up the situation here.
Look, I'd love to be able to sit here and just give you something straight away and make it nice and easy, crystal ball, after I've bought my lotto tickets.
Yeah.
But there are a whole lot of factors that go into this. Okay, as a very simple example, and I know some of my team who work very hard and make the team look very good, they'll hear me say this over and over again. So let's look at it at a very simple base. Look at traffic in Malaysia. I know everybody is concerned about traffic. Mm-hmm. So many people don't obey traffic laws, okay? We don't seatbelt our kids in, we drive through red lights. I'm guilty of that myself. We go too fast, we don't indicate when we turn, all the rest of it. So if you don't obey the basic laws of the land, the simple laws of the land, it erodes a little bit of your ethics. So to then go against the next law of the land is not so much of a step change, and the next law. So if you look at countries which have a better corruption perception, for example, you know, Norway, Denmark,
all the
New Zealand, all those. Yeah. Everyone says it must be so boring living in these clean countries, you know. But if you look at them, you know, they have congestion, but they don't have the amount of the such a wide number of people breaking those basic traffic laws. Okay, and I go back to traffic again. Well, one is a health and safety issue, but also the fact that, you know, when a large population does break those basic laws, it is not difficult to break the next set of laws and the next set as you go up. So things like that, from our own point of view, is something that we can do. Things that the MACC are trying to do around the name and shame and education, all that works, but is it something that's going to be fixed by tomorrow? Of course it's not. You know, it's going to take a bit of time.
I think that's really a fair point about it being reflective of also Malaysian society. It's not that the members and officials of MACC come from a vacuum. It really is reflective of who we are as well. And I'm sure your team will be delighted to hear you say that on air as well. All right, I think we're going to wrap things up. Just a quick
shout out to this team of yours.
No, thanks for it. Well, the team work extremely hard, and a lot of them are doing email reviews at the moment, which sounds exciting but is the world's worst job.
But Caroline knows that.
I know it.
And also, thanks to both of you, and thank you for putting on one of my favorite songs from the dinosaur era, which is Tom Sawyer by Rush.
And just very quickly, why is it one of your favorite songs?
Because it's something that I grew up with, I suppose. Neil Peart on the drums and that. And same with, you know, Foreigner and Journey and all those bands that I'm sure none of my team have ever heard of. And they'll be on Google as we speak.
All right.
And also to my wife, who's sat here very patiently.
It's World Anti-Corruption Day. In the studio with us is Alex Tan, partner in Forensics Lead. We've been speaking about corruption. If you missed any part of this program, you can download the podcast at www.bfm.my. Here it is. Rush, Tom Sawyer, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.